is, and as we continue to expand our economic burning of CO fossil fuels, all those kinds of things that go into it. You notice that the red line is the average, but there is a seasonal cycle that runs from January to January. This is basically the natural cycle of CO2. During the winter in the northern hemisphere, all the leaves are off the trees, so there's no photosynthesis, or very little, so their CO2 builds up in our atmosphere. As soon as that springtime comes and the leaves come out and things start to photosynthesize, there's enough vegetation in the northern hemisphere to pull that CO2 level down. Annual cycle, though, is not as great as what is happening over year after year, and so every year it actually pulls down a little bit less and it actually goes up a little bit more. So as we look at this then, this goes out to about 2007. We now, there's the 380 mark, we're now up at 390. We'll pass 400 probably by the year 2011, 2012, somewhere in there. Okay, now, as a consequence of this, we can actually look at some other longer term records. Again, ice cores and CO2. This is really hard to read. I thought it was going to be a little closer, but this is actually the 400,000 year record of CO2 in our atmosphere. And notice that it kind of jig-jags. Oftentimes this is referred to as kind of a sawtooth pattern. We work ourselves down into an ice age, which is at the bottom here. So during ice ages, CO2 is relatively low in the atmosphere. Once we come out of those ice ages, and usually it's fairly abrupt, CO2 goes up in our atmosphere. If we look at reconstructed temperatures, you will notice, and the important thing of this graph is that the temperatures follow the amount of CO2 and or the other way, that CO2 follows the temperatures. Okay, so over 400,000 years, we've been in lockstep between rising CO2 and warming temperatures, cooling CO2, or low CO2 and cool temperatures. On the right-hand side is the same graph drawn just a little bit differently. And the important thing is that notice in terms of temperatures and CO2s, we have almost never gone above 300 parts per million. This is the projected track of CO2 in our atmosphere as we go forward. Currently, we are at almost 400, projected up towards the year 2050. We will be in and around 500, 550, depending upon what we do in terms of our transportation and burning of fossil fuels. 2100, there are estimates that we may get to 1,200 parts per million before we ever slow down and stop. Okay, if the correlation between temperatures and CO2 continues to maintain itself, we can expect significant changes in terms of our temperature in the future. This is one of the reasons I don't sleep at night. The other reason I don't sleep at night has to do with this little videotape. It's the two-frame videotape. The expanded picture is from 2005. The other one is from 2007. This is the amount of Arctic sea ice left at the end of the summer at the top of our poles. Because we are warming our Earth, we don't see huge changes at our equator because they're already relatively warm. Where we are seeing the greatest amount of change today is in the Arctic and in the Antarctic. This has some significant consequences over the long term. 2007 is the lowest sea ice we've ever recorded, not only through satellites, but historically. The sea ice in the Arctic prevented the founding of the Northwest Passage for hundreds of years. There's multiple European explorers that lost their life up there. 2007, there was an open seaway that was the first time that the Northwest Passage opened up for surface shipping. And since that time, we, the American people and government, are building a Coast Guard station on the north shore of Alaska because we expect there to be significant ship travel through that passage in the coming years. This also has some potential outcomes. When we look at, this is actually the record of sea ice. You notice this starts back in the 50s. We have declining sea ice in the Arctic. As that continues to happen, we have spent, or sent our greatest modelers, our greatest minds to figure out how long summer sea ice in the Arctic is going to last. They came out in 2005 with this set of model results that suggests that, you know, we probably have till 2040 or maybe even 2100 before sea ice is completely gone in the Arctic. Unfortunately, this is actually the data that is being generated. It is outside of the modeled outcome. What this tells us is that we don't really understand all of the feedback systems within the Arctic sea ice system. And in fact, we're losing sea ice in the Arctic much faster. Some people have now revised their estimates down from mid-century losing all the sea ice as close as 2023, 2025 or so. When that happens, we will probably have significant damage to things like the polar bears and the walruses and all those cute and cuddly animals, as it were. One of the reasons this bothers most of us is, you know, we have positive feedback loop systems within all of our Earth systems. Then most of those, or at least a fairly good proportion of those, we don't really understand. And if you understand positive feedback loop systems, these are things that when they occur, they just basically feed back into its reoccurrence. And so you have a system that runs out of control. We do have negative feedback loop systems, which will dampen that. But we, for the most part, those are nice and they will do that, but we don't know when they're going to kick in or if they will kick in. The positive feedbacks that suddenly we can see things going out of control are always something to contemplate. Okay? So those are the two reasons I don't sleep. That's kind of the worldwide picture. As we continue into this decade, just came out, the summer of 2010 was the second warmest on record. It rivaled 1998, which has stood as the warmest in terms of worldwide temperatures. The Arctic sea ice for this summer is the third lowest ever recovered. That was just out this earlier this week. So all in all, we're looking at a climate system that is being severely affected, and we're seeing a significant amount of this up at the polar regions, but we do have some other places that is popping up. Moscow, Russia this year had the first time that it ever reached over 100 degrees, and there were a number of days, huge peat fires throughout the former Soviet Union. I just let on to how old I am. I still remember the Soviet Union. The other potential off of when we talk about the Arctic and the Antarctic, this is Greenland. It has an ice cap up here. If we would lose the ice cap, if it would melt completely, we would raise sea levels about 7 meters. We would lose most of Florida. The West Coast would not be particularly severely inundated except for in the port areas. Areas of San Francisco would be susceptible to storm surge and some other things. In Antarctica is a continent that has a lot of ice on it. There's no indication that we would lose Greenland or Antarctica on a relatively rapid basis, but if Antarctica was lost, we'd raise sea level 70 meters. And so that is a significant number when we consider what the coastlines are. And this may actually work into some of the things we might want to discuss in the long run. There are already and will be in the future climate change refugees that are seeking new places to live because of the inability have a life wherever it was that they were living. Okay? I'm not too far over yet. That's good. In terms of California, when we did our report, we relied upon a lot of modeling results that came out of some of the California universities. As far as I can tell, California was one of the first university systems and governments to really start to address this by studying many of these different aspects of climate change. So there is quite a bit of information out there. We expect in Fresno and in California to raise temperatures anywhere from 2 to 5 degrees by 2050, up to 10 or 11 degrees by 2100. People will probably give you much more accurate estimates of that during our discussion this morning. Remember, when we talk about temperature rising, we don't necessarily mean that if it's going to rise by 5 degrees, we're going from 112 to 117. We can actually get average temperatures to increase simply by warming our evenings. And in fact, that is probably what the majority of the stuff in the valley has been doing over the last few years. We do tend to put a lot of irrigation and a lot of water into our atmosphere. That tends to absorb and kind of dampen down the high temperatures. We can see seasonally we are seeing shifts. Our winter temperatures are much warmer than they have been. That also is probably nighttime temperatures to a large degree. Most of the change has been in winter and spring. Our spring is advancing. We find this as a characteristic of most of the northern hemisphere. I do some work in the Northern Great Plains in North Dakota. They are anywhere from 10 to 14 days in advance on their spring from what it has been historically. There is a potential that, especially in agricultural systems, you might outstrip your pollinators in terms of the flowering times. We have yet to see that, but that is a concern within some people in the climate change community. Summer temperatures have risen a bit, but not significantly. And fall is pretty much within the variability that we would expect. What does this do in terms of precipitation? Again, this is a little hard to read. The from 1950 to 1997, we started to lose the lower elevation of snowpack and the lower elevation of snow level. So we expect that places that traditionally may have had a week or two of a snowpack have already seen that disappear. Places that used to have snowfalls now probably have more rainfall than snowfall. As that happens, we basically we can continue to have a fairly significant snowpack up in the mountains, but the lower edge of it is probably being worked away. Water outside of our immediate region we identified as also a potential problem, and that is throughout the western United States. We are in the midst of a 10-year drought cycle. The large reservoirs on the Colorado River today are in and around 50% of their capacity. We think there's modeling that suggests that in terms of the long term, we will see a reduction in the amount of precipitation at some level. There are a few indications already that the jet stream, which brings us our winter snow and our winter moisture, has been shifting northwards incrementally. Here in the valley especially, we are very dependent upon these seasonal cycles of La Nina and El Ninos. El Ninos bring much more precipitation in because it pulls the jet stream down, and the large moist storms out of the Gulf of Alaska can pound the southern Sierras. During La Ninas, that doesn't occur. There is a standing high pressure that pushes that jet stream further north. Last year was an El Nino. We end up with some 120% of normal in terms of our snowpack. We are already seeing the signs we're going into a La Nina for this winter, which would indicate that it's going to be dry again, so it's going back. The rest of the West has been in more or less a 10-year drought cycle, and so these large reservoirs on the Colorado are actually suffering fairly significantly. This is the Lake Mead water level. And if you notice, 2010, we were the lowest, I think, that they've ever recorded. There was some modeling done by that was put out by the American Geophysical Union a year and a half ago. They suggest that we may actually achieve a reservoir status by 2017, 2020, somewhere in that, where we will be unable to generate electricity. If that's the case, that's most of Vegas right there. The other thing is, within that report, they suggest that maybe by the mid-20s, we may not be able to export water, fresh water, out of the lower Colorado system. Los Angeles gets about 22% of its rainfall, or its fresh water, out of the Colorado system. And having read a little bit about their history, I would suggest that they would start to probably look at our southern Sierras at that point. The folks of L.A. have usually gotten what they want. I don't know why that is, but anyway. So those are kind of the big things. So what we primarily focused on was temperatures and precipitation. And from that, we looked at kind of natural systems, and certainly these have been dealt with before. But obviously, there's going to be natural vegetation changes. We're going to see fairly significant shifts within the biomes and that occur today. They're going to probably go upslope. in some cases, they are already at places where they can't really go any further towards wetter or cooler conditions, whatever they need. And there will be some extinctions, especially within the Sierras. The deserts and other areas will also be affected. One of the things that we worry about to a certain extent is wildfires. This affects us especially because of air quality in our valley. The top two graphs, when we have early snowmelt years, so these would be essentially La Nina conditions, we get mega fires throughout the West. And when we have El Nino conditions, that snowpack tends to linger a bit longer. The water from that snowpack will seep into the ground and provide enough moisture that we tend not to get the big giant fires, but more sporadic small fires. Part of the process within the natural ecosystems, if you are shifting your boundaries and moving around on a landscape, you will leave vegetation that is susceptible for insect attacks, and then insect attacks lead to fires and promulgations through those kinds of systems. We have a number of other bits and pieces and points about the natural ecosystems. We think, and one of the things we pointed out was in the report, is that within the urban areas and that integration into more wildlands, there are a lot of susceptible residences and buildings, people that have built into these areas. But also within cities, if we are drying out vegetation, that we may potentially have inner city fires that are caused by dried out landscaping and such. Within the last month in Ashland, Oregon, there was a small fire that was started at a house. 9 homes eventually burned, and they essentially blamed it on a recent increase in water rates within the city that left people not watering their landscaping, and they allowed that landscaping to dry. And so this is one of the things that we kind of bounced around and became a little bit more and more worried about, that as we meter water here in the city of Fresno, that we potentially could leave some areas pretty susceptible to fairly large fires. We in Fresno use one of the highest rates of water usage in the United States. We use about 300 gallons per person per day. To give you a comparison, Tucson uses about 114. Phoenix is up about, I think they're 140 or so. So the metering of water will undoubtedly decrease a lot of that use, but in doing so, it's going to dry things out quite a bit. In terms of the humans in this story, we saw a number of potential public health consequences of climate change. These have been identified in other cities. There's things in terms of temperature change and precipitation. One of the things we didn't talk about is there's forecasts for more extreme weather occurrences, and then also ecosystem change. For the most part, these result in greater mortality, potential injuries, health issues, hospitalizations. Similarly, there are a number of different avenues that we could go down. We tended to choose we dealt with the primary outcomes of climate change. We dealt with a number of secondary outcomes of climate change. And then in a couple instances, we melded our minds together and came up with some of these perverse outcomes, things that people may not have actually thought about. Obviously, heat waves are one of our largest concerns in terms of increasing temperature, especially within the cities where we have urban heat island effects. This is one of those areas where we may actually have a little good news. It turns out that when we look at the effects of heat waves, people who experience heat on an annual basis fare much better than where heat suddenly occurs sporadically. In 2003, Western Eastern Europe suffered through a heat wave that took out 30,000 people, mostly because most of that area doesn't have air conditioning and they don't experience very hot, humid conditions over long periods of time, and they just weren't built. They weren't used to those kinds of conditions. Hey, I've lived through 117. I can do it. Come on, bring it on. That's what we say. So
we are.
But we do have a lot of people that are out working. We do have new legislation that covers much of this. But it's the vigilance of making sure that people who are in housing that they feel unprepared to open up in the evenings, ways to cool off, opening of cooling centers. All these things can be very effective at helping people deal with these things. Heat and all that other stuff will potentially get us a little worse air quality. And I have to say that this last summer has been beautiful. We've had more, I think, green days than probably any summer in some time. But we need to be vigilant about the precursors of pollution, and many of those are actually built upon hot sunshine, warm temperatures, those kinds of things. And then this is the last one I'm going to show, almost the last. We also, in terms of the potential of vermin, the potential of outbreak of diseases, we worry that insects, insect cycles are going to be expanding northwards. We are seeing, you know, dengue fever has cropped back up in the southwest recently. We're seeing some other things that we thought we had pretty much taken care of start to appear, reappear, not only in northern Mexico, but then approaching the southern borders. To give you bad news on top of bad news, all indications are, in terms of CO2 in plants, we see a fairly significant increase in the number of flowers on plants. And the amount of pollen per flower stays the same, but the number of flowers per plant increases. All of us who are slightly allergic to something in the air may be even more allergic. We also know that a lot of plants are increasing certain proteins. For example, with poison ivy becomes more poisonous with higher carbon dioxide levels. This is one of those kind of odd, perverse effects that nobody would have really have thought about. But once we start to look at it, we see that there are some changes. So those were kind of the big ideas that hopefully gives you a little background of what we are seeing here in Fresno in terms of climate change and also in terms of worldwide change. You know, there's any number of ways to get information, and so I spend most of my days plying through websites looking for the latest. In terms of, for us, this is the report we put out. It actually is available as a PDF. That is the website. It's on the Fresno State website. If you can find ICOA, which is the Institute of Climate, Oceans, and Atmosphere, on one of their sidebars it says projects, and you can get to Fresno Climate and download it and read it for yourself. I'm sure it'd be fascinating reading in the late evenings as you're about to go to sleep. And at that point, I think that's all I pretty much have to say. So I just thank you for listening. And there will be a test at the end of the hour, a quiz. Anyway, so thank you. Right.
Is that a magic number for some reason?
There, you know, it used to be that the climate science community thought that we really needed to be scared if we got above 450, 400 or so. There are some modeling efforts over the last 4 or 5 years that have really indicated that 350 was the magic number, and we've already passed it. We think that already in the works is the 5-degree rise. We don't think that there's any way that that's going to not happen. So now we are working on the next 5 degrees, which would take us up to 10 by the end of the century. Because the 5 degrees is already in the works, it may be that by the end of the century it would be above another 5. It all really depends upon the scenario of what we do in terms of policy about burning fossil fuels. And, you know, not to be too glum about this, but in some stuff I've been reading lately, it's been pointed out a number of times that if we were to totally commit to a, you know, Apollo-like program tomorrow to go away from fossil fuels into clean energy, even with no environmental restrictions, with no kinds of protests or no concern about anything, it would still take us 10 years to get a nuclear reactor online. Estimates are we need like 1,000 nuclear reactors to even make a dent into what we're doing. So there is a lag time between the temperature showing up with the CO2 we have now, but there's also a lag time in terms of our response at this point to how we're going to slow that down. So, all right. Too much. Is that a $27 answer for a 5 cent question?
Another question?
Yep.
On the 300 gallons a day, here in Fresno, is that just an urban usage, or is that also?
My understanding is it's basically all the water used divided by the population.
Okay. Yeah. So for, say, the entire county or for the
city? Clovis already meters their water, I believe. Yeah. That first water bill is going to be a shock. There might be rioting in the streets or something. Abe?
One more.
Oh, yes.
Yep, this is
this
it.
Is it.
You're in the right place. Good question.
I don't know if there must be a green blog. Tom, somebody. There is greenfresno.com.
Tom Cotter.
Tom Cotter, yeah.
Tom Cotter's got a green blog. The city.
Thank you, Dr. Vandewater. Before Kate gets back up here and introduces the next guest, I just want to do a little minor cleanup item. In case you didn't know where the restrooms are here in this building, it takes probably a good week and a half to get there, but you need to go down the hallway and hang a right and then take an immediate left and then another right, another left, and they should be on your left. So it is a little difficult to get there, but I did want to give everyone that information just in case you needed to use the facilities. Thank you.
Thanks, Rocky. So we're going to make a couple changes to the agenda now and just go ahead and stick with the science discussion right now. And I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Marnie Koopman, who's a climate change scientist for the National Center for Conservation Science and Policy, and as I mentioned, one of our partners on this effort. So she's going to talk a little bit about the research that they've done.
All right, thank you. As Kate mentioned, I'm with the National Center for Conservation Science and Policy, and we are a conservation organization out of Ashland, Oregon. But I actually got my start here in the Central Valley. I used to work on the Naval Petroleum Reserves out of Bakersfield, out of Taft, actually, for many years. So the Central Valley systems are very dear to my heart, and it's fun to be back here. I'm from California originally. And so we held a workshop in August, as Kate mentioned, that brought together experts on the natural systems of the Fresno region. And we talked about how those systems might be impacted by many of the threats, including climate change, but also population growth and development in the area, and air quality especially, and water use. And so we talked about how the natural systems might become resilient in the future to these many threats that are kind of coming down the pipe. First I would like to point out, I put stacks of these around the room, but nobody's sitting over here, so I'll bring them back over. But these are a report that we put together where we actually brought the models to the local scale so that you can see what climate change is expected to look like in 2035 to 40, and then also 2075 to 85. So you can look kind of mid-century and then late century at what the projections are for this specific region and how that might affect things like vegetation type on the landscape, might affect snowpack and stream flow and all of these other important components. So I encourage you to pick up those reports. There should also be a two-page insert, which didn't make it into all of the blue folders, but I will try and track those down and make sure everybody gets one that just give a summary of what our natural systems workshop found, what we talked about. So one of the questions that we posed to everybody at this workshop was, what is it that you value in this region? What is it that makes this region special? Why do you live here and stay here? And we got amazing responses of, a lot of people welled up as they were speaking. They love the diversity of the area, that we have agriculture on the valley floor, that we have these wonderful lakes, rivers, mountains right in our backyard. And so people obviously feel very attached to this region. They have a high quality of life they appreciate, and the natural systems really support that quality of life. So that's why one reason that we really talked about, well, how do we retain these into the future if they're that important? Let's see if I can figure this out. Oops. So as we move forward and we look at maintaining this quality of life that keeps people here and that makes us feel so attached to this region, we do have some threats. And those include things like development and population growth. Air quality is obviously one that's very difficult to deal with. And climate change. And what our organization is doing is trying to get climate change included in kind of the list of threats that people discuss and that they plan for and that they include in their normal planning strategies for cities and counties and states. And so we need to have a better understanding of it, what it might look like in your own backyard as we plan for this. And I argue that it should be included, you know, in a longer list of all of the issues that we plan for. And so as we talk about climate change, I'd like to pull it out of kind of its political context, which distorts, I think, the discussion a little bit, and talk about it in a risk assessment context, which is how we really deal with all of these other risks, such as earthquakes and fires and floods and all of the other issues that we deal with. And a risk assessment is something that everybody's used to using. You use it in most of your daily life decisions. So just recently I had to decide if I should make a late night run for milk. And, you know, I assessed the probability of running out of milk, and the probability was medium to high that we might run out of milk. And then I assessed the cost of running out of milk. Was that something that was going to disrupt my life? And I have a 5-year-old. So all of a sudden, the cost of running out of milk is a lot higher than it would have been otherwise. So I used risk assessment to say, okay, you know, the probability is high for running out of milk. The cost is high. I should probably run out and get some milk. So we use this all the time. And this is used when the federal government was deciding whether to force car makers to install seatbelts into all of their cars. So they looked at the cost. The risk of people dying in car accidents was getting relatively high as more and more cars were on the road. The cost of installing a seatbelt was $20,000 per person if you look at installing seatbelts in all cars, whereas the cost if you were not going to install those seatbelts and you just had to pay the lawsuit settlements when people died in car accidents was $300,000. So they decided that based on the risk and on the cost, that it made sense to force the car makers to put seatbelts in all cars. So that's an example of where the risk was fairly high, or the probability, I should say. The probability was fairly high, and the cost made it make sense. In the airline industry, the probability of a terrorist attack is actually very, very low, but the cost is so high that we're willing to put a lot of resources into preventing terrorist attacks. And this is just because if we have a single terrorist attack, the entire industry of airline travel could be disrupted in people's lives and their livelihoods, and our economy could be disrupted. And so we're willing to put some serious resources into something that has a relatively low probability. And this is common in a lot of ways. Things like fire insurance, the probability that you and your house are going to have a fire is relatively low, yet you're willing to pay for fire insurance and put some resources to prevent that prevent the risk. So if we turn this back to climate change, we can look at the two components. We can look at the probability of climate change occurring and the cost or the impact of climate change occurring. And this is important because a lot of people look at the probability and they ignore the cost. So the probability according to the scientists, is greater than 95%. So most climate change scientists, the ones that have worked with the International Panel of Climate Change, agree that there's a greater than 95% chance that climate change is occurring and that it's human caused. But many people still question that science, and I'd like to say that's okay. I think it's good to question science. I think it's good to ask questions, to be educated, and to really understand issues. But we also want to look at the cost and say, okay, well, let's say the probability is less than 95%, or maybe we think it's only 30%. But what about the cost? Would that make it make sense to put resources into either preventing climate change or adapting to climate change? And luckily, there has been some recent research on the cost of climate change. So in California, the California Energy Commission produced a report that showed that $100 billion worth of infrastructure is at risk from a 1.4 meter sea level rise, which is a fairly conservative estimate of sea level rise. Excuse me. And a 1.4 meter increase in sea level would cause cause a risk to hazardous waste facilities, healthcare facilities, schools, power plants, roads and highways, and numerous international airports, including all three Bay Area airports of Oakland, San Francisco, and San Jose. So I took, you can't really read this. I apologize for that. I took a bunch of independent studies from economists, mostly university economists around the nation, that have looked at the cost of climate change on different systems in our country. And so we have $100 billion in infrastructure cost to California. We also have a $6 billion per year loss of agriculture in the Central Valley projected under climate change due to drought conditions. We have losses to the ski industry of, I think, $275 million per year just within the next 15 years. We have billions of dollars per year lost in agriculture in the Midwest just due to lower productivity. We have lake declines in Lake Michigan that cause $4.1 billion per year in lost economic value. Then we have the increased dredging that would be required in those lakes to continue shipping, and that dredging costs many millions of dollars every year. We have increased hurricanes that are projected across the southeastern United States, and then we have infrastructure along all of the coasts. And so once you end, and increased firefighting is going to be very, very expensive. They're projecting $4.6 billion just for a few western states collectively. Then we have moving villages in Alaska projected to cost $1.3 billion. So when you add up all of these costs, and these are just a sample, but when you add them up, one estimate came up with $1.9 trillion per year by 2040, which isn't very far in the future. And that's 13% of the GDP. So one point that I'd like to make is that, you know, we can debate whether or not the likelihood of climate change happening is high or low, but that doesn't change that the cost is extremely high, and that when we make rational decisions on how to plan for the future, we plan for all sorts of uncertainty in many different risks, and we're willing to put resources into it. So here we go for climate change. The largest body of scientists on this issue agree that there's a greater than 95% chance, likelihood, that climate change is occurring, and the cost is estimated at $1.9 trillion per year. So I'd just like to give put everybody in that mind frame of how to think about climate change, how to decide if we're going to plan for climate change or are we going to not plan for climate change. So today we're talking about climate change adaptation. I'd like to talk quickly about both mitigation and adaptation and how they're related. Mitigation, you can think of climate change as a car crash. So you're in a car, it's driving along, and you suddenly realize you're going to crash. You have a couple tools, but you can't prevent that crash. So your tools include the brakes, which are going to slow you down, and that's mitigation. Mitigation can slow climate change down. It can... if we reduce our emissions now, we can eventually slow down the rate of warming. Adaptation are the airbags. It means that once you crash, it's not going to hurt quite so much as it would have otherwise. And so today we're talking about adaptation because there are many effects of climate change that we're already seeing or that are already in the works based on the emissions that have been put out into the atmosphere. And we really need to plan for those. It doesn't mean we're not going to use the brakes. It just means that we need to use both tools. So what exactly is climate change adaptation? Adaptation includes increasing both the resilience and the resistance of natural and socioeconomic systems to climate change. And I'll explain those a little bit. Resilience is the ability to bounce back after disturbance. And an example of a resilient community actually is in Nashville, Tennessee recently when they had the very large floods. And what people saw there was it was a very different response than the one in, say, Katrina, that people were fairly resilient. They had low numbers of casualties. The churches responded very quickly. They had systems set up for emergency response. They had good communication. And they were able to deal with this large disaster and bounce back. And then there's resistance, which is the ability to withstand the disturbance. And an example for this might be that if we have higher species diversity, say, in our forests, we have more tree diversity, then as climate change progresses, we have a greater chance of retaining that forest on the landscape. Some species might be affected by climate change, but others might remain there in place. So we'll continue to have a forest. It might be different, but it'll be more resistant to climate change with higher diversity. So today we're talking about strategies that might include and might improve resilience. And our approach to this is to integrate this planning for climate change across different systems. This has economic systems, built systems, cultural systems, natural systems, and human systems. And this came about because we were talking about natural systems, since we're a conservation organization, and the risk of climate change. And everybody in our whole group, who are all biologists and ecologists, kept getting back to the issue that they were concerned about their families and their communities as we talked about these risks. It's not just the natural systems. And you can't really separate the two with socioeconomic and natural. And so by integrating our planning for climate change and for other risks to the area, it makes sense to make sure that as we make new plans, maybe for flood control, that planning is integrated with new plans for maybe maintaining riparian systems for aquatic species. And so it's important to make sure that in the different systems, our plans for the future don't conflict or don't increase maybe stressors on other systems. And then as we move forward, we'd also like to make sure that adaptation planning is compatible and complementary to mitigation planning. So there are many things that we can do that might increase maybe carbon storage in natural vegetation while also potentially reducing the risk of wildfire to residences. So there's ways that we can pull these together. So in our discussions on the natural systems, people were very concerned about the basic functions that ecosystems provide that people really rely on. And specifically in this area, there are some that are heavily relied on. Forage for cattle is important, and that's a benefit that we get from just natural production of grass. Then we have floodplain function. Floodplains hold large amounts of water when there's a sudden storm, and climate change is expected to increase the incidence of large storms because the warmer temperature air can hold more water. And so we could see larger storms, not necessarily more storms, but those could, so you could get a lot of rain coming down really fast, and that can be held in a floodplain. When that floodplain has been developed or disconnected, then those waters are going to rush down towards the cities and the developed areas. So floodplain function is very important. It has a huge value, although most people don't think of that as something worth monetary value. Then here we have Sequoia National Park, which brings in quite a bit of economic value to the area. We have natural pollinators, which are responsible for 15% of pollination, native species pollinators. So we rely on that on European honeybees quite a bit, but native species also provide pollination. And then wetlands and riparian areas, which filter out pollution out of our waterways. They filter out sedimentation, and they allow water to infiltrate back into the groundwater, which is extremely important so that we have groundwater available for things like agriculture. So we don't know how much many of these are worth, but one study showed that up to $312 million per year could be lost in forage production for cattle due to climate change, and that is across the state. So we could lose quite a bit of forage for cattle, and that would reduce the productivity of that industry. And we don't know specifically, you know, how much these other ones are worth in dollars, but we do know that they're extremely valuable specific to this region. So we had a day discussion with many of the experts on natural systems in this area, and they were mostly people from the Forest Service, ecologists, hydrologists, wildlife biologists, and many other ologists were there. From the Forest Service, from the Park Service, from some of the nonprofits, from the city and county government, and many from the state as well. And we broke out into groups kind of similar to what we're going to do today and talked about what concerns they have, thinking about climate change and the other stresses to this area, what their concerns were, what impacts they expect to see in the future, and how we might plan now maybe to reduce some of those impacts and retain resilient systems and retain those ecosystem services that are so important. So water availability came out as the top issue of the day. People are very concerned about competition over water, about natural systems not getting enough water in the future. If snowpacks decline and water availability goes down, you know, I think many people were concerned that the competition for water would become very high and it would be difficult to retain water in rivers and streams and lakes. So the number one recommendation was to conserve water. And there's a handout that I will try and make sure everyone gets. I can't even figure out where their stack went. So, but it lists many ways that they recommended conserving water. But I think this group would be would have many other ideas for how this region can conserve water. How can we better prepare for a drought? And how can we make sure that all of the different needs for water get met? So there are many different ways that we can conserve water. But putting a lot of emphasis on that recommendation, that was by far the most important one. They recommended restoring vital habitats and functions. So we've already lost 99% of the wetlands in California. And the function that those provide in filtering water, in providing wildlife habitat, in allowing water to get back into the groundwater. So those are really important functions that have been lost. And if we can restore some of those, then the impacts of climate change and of population growth and of all of these other things in the future might be more manageable. And another recommendation was to store water in dry lake beds. On the valley floor, there are quite a few lake beds that historically would support migrating waterfowl, would support all sort of many aquatic species. And they are used currently for farming. And something that's really interesting is in parts of Africa, they have similar systems where they actually farm on the edges of the lake bed. And then throughout the summer, as the lake bed dries up, they farm further and further into the lake bed. And it creates a very fertile system for them. They don't have the same water infrastructure that we do, but it's something that's sustainable in that system. So storing water in these areas, one of the reasons for that recommendation is that with the snowpack receding, we're expecting to have much earlier snowmelt, and it'll come in a much quicker pulse than it used to in the past. And with an early and fast snowmelt, it becomes very difficult to store that water in the reservoirs that we have built in the past, because we've built reservoirs that are made to take up kind of a slower and later snowmelt. So we're going to need some new ways to store water if we can't store it quite as efficiently in our reservoirs as we used to be able to. And that's where this recommendation came from. Storing water in wetlands, meadows, and riparian areas. This recommendation was made because in the higher elevations, we rely right now on snowpack for water storage. And as that snowpack melts off slowly, it starts to replenish the aquifers. Well, if it melts off very quickly, then we won't get as much groundwater replenishment. But if we can store more water in the higher elevations in wetlands, meadows, and riparian areas, it'll serve the same function. That water will be stored early on in the spring and will trickle down more gradually throughout the summer. So another issue was just concern over loss of habitat for native species. As the climate changes, the species that are adapted to that climate will no longer find the most suitable climate or food or habitat that they need to survive. And so many species could lose their habitat in this region. And there's already a lot of habitat loss, and so we have then that stress would be exacerbated. So one thought is to reduce some of the stressors that are already causing these habitats to decline. So if we could reduce maybe the number of roads in some areas, if we could reduce overgrazing in some areas and have better stewardship of the lands that currently do support wildlife, that wildlife could become more resilient. And one thing that I just want to point out was that the natural systems folks were very supportive of cattle grazing, but it often came up as a stressor because they wanted it done in a less degrading way. They want to see cattle grazing continue because it keeps lands open, it keeps things from being developed, it can have a very positive influence in many ways, but they're very concerned about the effects of cattle overgrazing and the effects on riparian systems specifically. And increasing conservation efforts, especially doing this in a way that looks at climate change specifically. So as the climate changes, some areas will have a cooler microclimate or more precipitation. Some areas are going to be able to hold on to the species that are historically there. Other areas are not. And if we can start to identify some of those and target those for conservation. And then they suggested increasing collaboration and leveraging. And they gave an example for leveraging. I think there's a current flood control project that is going on, and I'm sorry, I don't know the specifics on that. But many people said, you know what, there's this project that already is on the ground, it's already funded, and if we could tie in, you know, some improvements to riparian habitat to that project and therefore leverage those funds, then we can benefit both flood control and riparian systems at the same time. So if we can look for more ways to work across sectors and leverage funds and get more done with small amounts of money. Another concern is the inability of species to move. So as the climate changes, species are going to start to look for a more suitable climate, and they're expected to disperse to new areas. But we have fragmentation of habitat that might prevent some of those movements. And the science says that about 30% of species are expected to go extinct under climate change over the next 100 years. But they also clearly have shown that if you can retain some linkages, that those extinctions can be minimized. So it's important to think long-term for species conservation of, you might have a really good patch of habitat now, but where is the really good habitat in the future, and how can we keep those connected so that species can disperse to new areas? There has been a lot of planning already in this region, which just shocked me, on connectivity, about providing corridors and connectivity throughout the region and throughout the state. A lot of the planning has been done, and we really need to look towards implementation at this point. We have this report, which is coming out in October, from the Southern Sierra Partnership called the Framework for Cooperative Conservation and Climate Adaptation in the Southern Sierra Nevada and Tehachapi Mountains. And this report has identified areas that could be climate change refuges, areas that will be very important for maintaining biodiversity over the long term, and areas that are currently conserved and could be linked to other conservation areas as well. Sorry. Just letting people write that down. And we also have the effort by the Tulare Basin Wildlife Partners, and Carol Combs is here. She spearheaded that effort. This shows where we might have wildlife corridors throughout the Tulare Basin and identifies areas for linkages. So again, a lot of the planning has been done, and looking to tie these plans into ongoing projects and to future funding would be very important. So the group was also very concerned about wildfire frequency and intensity. This graph below shows the very close relationship between temperatures and wildfire. This is from Westerling. It was in one of the top journals, Science Magazine. And in red, we have wildfire frequency, and in the black line is temperature. And this is from 1970 all the way through 2003. And you can see there's a very, very close link. So as we have higher and higher temperatures, we can expect to have more wildfires. The projections show a 2 to 4 times increase in wildfire for the Sierra Nevadas. So people are very concerned about increases in wildfire and the effects that could have on the natural systems. One recommendation is to improve forest management so that if we can have higher diversity in the forest, we might have some more drought-tolerant species that could allow forests to be less impacted by fire. And thinning, obviously, is one important approach. Many people would like this approach limited to areas around residences because wildfire is a very important natural process that allows for regeneration of many tree species and is important for wildlife. And so we don't want to limit wildfire too much, but it's important around residences and other areas where it might really impact people that we could thin the forests and reduce the likelihood of fire, reducing fuel load. So I already pretty much covered that topic. We will have many more recommendations. We're going to put out a final report by December, and it will include many other recommendations. I'm just giving you the highlights from our discussion. Improving land use planning basically means to reduce the amount of development in the foothills and in high fire risk areas, because as we have these increases in fire, it'll become more and more expensive to fight those fires and to protect people's homes. And the cost estimates that have been done are pretty astounding as far as how much more it could cost in the future. And then finally, they're concerned about increases in invasive aquatic and terrestrial species because as the climate changes and native species decline, there's going to be open spaces for these species to come in. They're more competitive. They do better under warmer temperatures. And we could really see some areas taken over by invasive species. They recommended reducing existing stressors. So these are, again, things like overgrazing, roads, sedimentation of rivers, things that might reduce the resilience of the native species that then would allow the invasives to come in. And implementing rapid assessment and response, more monitoring of invasive species, and a plan on the ground for what to do when they're located. So finally, I just want to close by saying that from talking with the group of people that I talked with in our August workshop, it was quite apparent how important these natural systems are to the quality of life for people in this region, that they really enjoy boating and hiking and hunting and enjoying the outdoors, and they value agriculture, they value all of the different ecosystems, and they just value having this great diversity in one place. And so it's important that we think about that as we move forward on how to retain these systems under climate change and population growth and the other stressors. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marnie. We're actually running a little over, so I'm going to ask if you have any questions. Marnie will be around, so if you can just approach her during lunch and get any questions that you need to get answered at that time. And I'm going to introduce our other partner in this effort, Dr. Susie Moser, and she's going to be talking about some of the social and economic issues.
Thank you, and welcome, everyone. I have a feeling that you probably are a little overwhelmed with all the bad news. I just recommend, since we all have been sitting here for an hour by now, how about we all just get up for once, breathe, turn around, whatever, and just sit back down. Great. All right. So on toward a vibrant, prosperous, and sustainable Fresno County. Right. This is the good news part, no? Well, somewhat. What I want to actually do in this presentation is to bring our attention to the social systems, the human systems that we're here to discuss today. And the main focus that I want to actually take is not just to summarize what you have received in the invitation. Maybe some of you have glanced through it or even read it. There is, even in case you are not don't have enough yet, there is a 70-page underlying report, fully referenced and has a lot more detail. I'm not going to try to cover all of that in all its breadth. What I would like to do instead is to lay a foundation for the rest of the discussions that we're going to have today, and that is to essentially teach you how to do a vulnerability and adaptation assessment, at least one that's sort of qualitative and, you know, gets you thinking in those terms. So let me figure out how this works. What button should I push? Yep. Uh-huh. On. Aha. Oh, okay. Great. All right. So what I want to do first, and I'm going to go through that part relatively quickly, given the great foundation that Peter and Marnie have just already laid, is sort of give an overview of why are we thinking about vulnerability and adaptation in the first place, and then focus in on what does climate change mean in the context of other stressors for populations, communities in Fresno County, for the economy, and then also for the services and infrastructure that make it actually run. And then just give a very brief overview of what we're going to do. So let me make the first connection. And we've heard this now before. I'm just going to put it in slightly different ways. And I think of sort of the two approaches we need to manage the risks from climate change and other stressors, sort of as a way of putting your arm around it on the front end and on the back end. So in the end, you hug the problem. So the front end, you've heard Marnie use the word mitigation. I'm actually connecting it with the things that have already been going on here in this county, and that is thinking about smart growth. Smart growth basically leads to more compact development, reducing of vehicles mile traveled, and, you know, basically our energy use in how we live. And all of that leads to a reduction of the greenhouse gases that cause global change. So that's the front end of the problem. That's slowing it down, reducing the stress, so that we don't barrel down that road as hard as we are currently doing. The second part is adaptation, and that is to basically take advantage of whatever potential changes are arising or minimizing the negative impacts of that. So, and there's, you know, you already heard some of the strategies that Marnie proposed, resistance and resilience. It's very similar for social systems. What I'm going to focus on in my presentation is reducing our vulnerability to it. So it's not just what comes from climate, sort of, if you will, from on high. It is also what is already going on the ground, okay? So if you think about this, imagine that a flu epidemic is coming through. And, you know, who gets it, who doesn't? Well, people who are already stressed for whatever reason, they're more likely to also, you know, get hit with the flu because they simply don't have as much resistance, immune system is down, whatever. That's what I'm talking about, okay? The already existing stresses make you more vulnerable to, if then comes the additional stress from climate change. So whether or not you want to believe in climate change, whether or not we know with certainty what's coming, you can actually focus on reducing the vulnerability, so no matter what comes, you're in better shape. And it has benefits for you, even if it doesn't show up. So that's the basic idea. Well, there's actually a third choice we have, and that is to do nothing. And don't take my word for it. I've taken these bullets of negative trends that are already occurring here in Fresno County or in the Valley from the blueprint. Basically, things of loss of high-quality agricultural land, increasing health problems. Fresno is almost infamous for its, you know, not just the bad air quality, but issues with pulmonary disease, obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and then related to that, the growing healthcare cost. So those are existing stresses. Poor access to, ironically, fresh and healthy food choices, or where people can go and exercise, increased traffic congestions, all the air pollution that goes with that, lack of affordable housing, high unemployment rate or seasonal unemployment, and then the groundwater overdraft and subsidence related to it. So these are already things that you already deal with. This is the existing vulnerability, if you will, for the county, okay? Okay, and this is why we're here to talk about it. Why do you want to do this? I'm not going to actually spend a lot of time on the blueprint and the sort of elements of that vision because we're going to have a little bit of a presentation on that just before lunch. But basically, the point is you want to have a healthy environment, a healthy community, a diverse community, just, sustainable, prosperous. Those are the basic elements of this vision. In this context, my view is that climate change is just one additional stressor. You're going to have a lot of stress going on. You know, if you just look at the growth trajectories of population growth, congestion, and all that stuff, you're going to have plenty to go to, you know, to deal with. Climate change is just going to make that harder to achieve your vision. And so that's why I think it's important to, in the best interest, to actually look at what are your existing problems and how can we address those more effectively and in that way prepare for climate change. I don't know what to point for. This is not, oop, and then it goes twice. Okay, again, I'm not gonna go into detail on this. There's a lot of solid work that's already been done here for this long report and the short summary. We've drawn heavily on all of these existing strategies. In the back of this long report, for example, we have about 10 pages where we took just two of the key documents, the blueprint and the study that Peter referred to earlier, what they did in 2008 and all the suggested strategies for addressing smart growth and emission, and to some extent they already began to look at adaptation. And we basically just said, you know, if you want to do this, if you tweak it just a little bit, you're going to also do something for adaptation. So it's essentially an extension of the existing work. And there are just a few other pieces that I mentioned here. The state, by the way, has a statewide adaptation plan as well. And I think there's a lot of useful strategies you can draw on to link into. It is mostly focused right now on state agencies cleaning up their own house. In next iterations, there will be ways to link to local communities much more. I simply didn't have time to do that in the first round. Is it going to go? Yep. Okay. So I want to quickly say something about what we mean by adaptation. You already heard a number of definitions, but I want to point to the little boxes at the bottom here and say something. Adaptation means essentially anything from coping with, say, another extreme event that comes, recovering from that, bouncing back, and you know, basically continuing to function, but getting back to the status quo that was before, to making some more substantial adjustments in systems. Maybe you change some rules, maybe you change building codes, maybe those kinds of things, all the way to very substantial transformations. We heard earlier things about sea level rise. Those high numbers that you heard, they're not going to occur immediately. But for, say, people in Bangladesh, where you have 30 million people living within 3 feet of sea level rise, now that's a lot of people who have to find a new home. They will not just, you know, raise their building a little bit and stay in place. They will have to find a more, you know, they will have to find a new home essentially. And so that's where we're talking more substantial transformations. You know, I'm not suggesting this at all, but imagine an equally substantial transformation in the valley with no more agriculture. I mean, that's what we're talking about, something that substantial, okay? This is not the kind of thing we're talking about here today, but adaptation includes the full range from sort of dealing with the next thing coming to that deep transformation that a society could go through. Now, what do we do in a vulnerability and adaptation assessment? The first piece is, and I always like to actually start with that. That's not necessarily what other scientists do, but I like to start with that because that's something we can get very good data on. We can start with that right now, no matter what climate change will occur. And that is to look at your current socioeconomic trends and stresses and maybe what you expect, you know, how demography will change, population changes. And from that, we can develop an idea of what are our existing vulnerabilities. The second piece is then to look at in what ways is our community, our county, sensitive to climate already? When you have an agricultural county like this, I don't need to explain that. You have a lot of sensitivity. Is there enough water? How hot is it at certain times during the year? Are you getting extreme events? Those kinds of things. So those are the kinds of things you're interested in, and that gives you, and then you look at the trends. And here we use the best science that we have, not a certain thing, but it's the best we have, right? So rather than driving blindly, it gives us a little bit more than blind. So then you get the idea about how are you exposed to different and changing climate risks. And then putting those two together, you then say, well, what can we influence? What can we do to reduce our exposure to these risks, our sensitivity to that, or how can we put ourselves in a better position to respond to whatever may show up? And that then goes into, you know, identifying those options, what existing strategies are there, could we modify them a little bit, or do we need something new that doesn't exist yet? And then what do we need to do to sort of reduce the barriers to actually make it happen? Where does the money come from? Is there a law that prevents us from doing it? Those kinds of things. Do we have enough people to do it? Et cetera, et cetera. That's what we're going to do this afternoon. Thinking about, you know, in light of what you're hearing from me and the previous presentations, what can we do to influence that system to keep it going in the direction we want? Now, I want to just put this together and say a little bit more about this, these aspects of vulnerability. So what will happen with climate change is not just a function of climate, okay? That's one of the important take-homes that I want you to remember. Actual impact is a result of what comes from climate and how vulnerable are we. Now, what does vulnerability mean? It means this. The first thing you want to think about is who or what is actually at risk, exposed to it. That's what we call exposure. So, for example, if we say there is, you know, there will be heat extremes, you might think about, well, people is, you know, are exposed to it, but mostly the people who work outside and who have no air conditioner, right? The people who are in here, I'm freezing. I don't know about you, but I'm not exposed to whatever the temperature outside is right now. But if I'm working in a field, that's a whole different game. If I'm, you know, thinking about cattle, chicken, they are exposed in, you know, enclosures suffering from extreme heat. And on top of that, who is sensitive? Imagine it is 117, I heard that, and you're 13 or you're 35 or you're 83. Who do you think is going to be more affected by this? Well, we know this already from past experience. Elderly and infants are far more sensitive to extreme heat, and so they're much more vulnerable overall than the people in this room. And then finally, the last piece is our ability to deal with what comes down the pike. If you're exposed and you're sensitive, but you have a place to go and be cool, or you have good health care, you have good health insurance, well, not so bad, you know? If you don't, and lots of people in this county are very poor and don't have good access to health care and don't have good access to all kinds of things, you know, then they're in a much worse situation. So it's the three components: whether you're at risk, how sensitive you are to whatever you're at risk, and then whether or not you can deal with it, that ultimately at the end of the day says how vulnerable you are. Those are the things we want to look at, and I'm just going to give you now a few examples. Let's take this example of extreme heat. I just walked you through that. Elderly and infants and those who already have some health issues are most sensitive, so that's the sensitivity issue. Exposure varies by age group. Now look at this map that we put here together. The first one, you can barely see the sidebar here, but basically what it says at the top bar is the population over 65. Now, if you actually ask these people and whether they consider themselves elderly, no. It's always the 10 years ahead or something that we think is the old population. But we know from from health studies, basically, that people over 65 tend to be more sensitive to heat. So we just mapped them on using census data, and look where they are. They're essentially up in the mountains. Not so bad, okay? So their exposure is not as bad. maybe on the worst days. But just around Fresno, there you see that little dark ring right around it. It's sort of like the suburbs of Fresno City. Lots of folks there who are highly vulnerable to sensitive to it. The bottom map that you see is children under five, infants. Now, interestingly, most of the children in this county live in the hottest part of it. Not good. Okay? This is what I want you to look at when we later work through this, that where people live and what the climatological risks are in those areas quite differs. And you have to look at it basically by group by group. Here's another one. And I'm going to put here the Hispanic population. You're not surprised by that map, the purple one. Basically, those are people who work predominantly in agriculture and in service industries. And especially in agriculture, people work in outdoors. Exposed in the highest, hottest, and most air-polluted area of the county. Folks have, yes, a law that is supposedly to protect them, but we all know that folks who work in those fields get paid by the box that they pick. They don't have a lot of incentive to actually, you know, take their breaks and whatever. So we know that there are difficulties in those things being implemented. And we, you know, hear that every year with heat-related deaths. So that's one group that is extremely exposed. And in fact, the Hispanic and Latino population already has the highest rates of asthma and diabetes. So that increases their sensitivity to additional stressors from heat and air pollution. And then, you know, there are issues related to poverty, seasonal low-wage unemployment or employment, and low healthcare coverage, which affects people's response capacity. So look at that map, the yellow and orange rates. What that map shows people is the number of people or percentage of people living below the federal rate of poverty. Forget exactly the number, but it's a ridiculously low number, basically, of annual income per person or per family. So again, the folks who are not only highest exposed and have high sensitivity are also the folks who have already a low response capacity. Okay? So you see how these factors begin to accumulate. This is one that's just related to floods. We took two maps from the previous general plan for the county. The top one, you can barely see it. There are not a lot of floodplains, 100-year floodplains. The lower map is a map of the area that would be affected if there was a dam failure. And you, we list the dams here that are considered high risk in this county. What's interesting about that, of course, is that, you know, this includes some of the most highly populated areas of the county. And with climate change, even if there is a general drying trend, we do expect, as Marnie and Peter both suggested, that there are these higher, more intense rainfall and higher runoff in the early part of the year. So if those two combine, you put more stress on those dams. So even if overall, on average, over the year, maybe the water availability may decline, you still get these extreme events, and you have to be ready for them. Now, we all know that our levees, dams, and structures that we have to protect ourselves are aging. Already in this county, there are many that are privately owned that are not up to federal standards of flood protection for 100-year flood. Just recently, that was sort of, you got all the stamp on that, and flood insurance rate went up for a lot of people in this county. So those are the kinds of issues that affect how well people are prepared. Why should, you know, a public institution worry about privately owned levees? Well, and we live in a country where we actually do care when something happens to our neighbor, even if it happens to them on their private land. In the end, we try to protect them, we save them from a flood, we pull them off a roof, whatever, and we try to bail them out, right? So those, even if it's now on private land, I think as public agencies or decision makers, we have to be concerned with what happens to our neighbors. Another example. Here I use again the map of the elderly. One of the things we know about the elderly is that many of them actually need assistance, both to prepare, to deal with, you know, things that Marnie mentioned already about reducing the fuel around their homes. They might need help in getting out of their houses. Now, those areas where most of the elderly live in this county are actually the least accessible. It takes you the longest to get to them at the time when they need help fast. Okay, so very important that we think about sort of how do we plan for the increased risk of wildfire and are ready to respond rapidly to help those most in need. If public infrastructure can't get there, can you establish maybe a buddy system to make sure that everybody gets, you know, pulled out by their neighbors? Those are the kinds of things we can talk about. Now, let me just say one word in terms of social assets we have to reduce that. And the number one thing we have to reduce our social vulnerability is actually us people. And I just list a bunch of groups here: faith community, civic groups, representatives of underserved communities, government services certainly, but also businesses that keep our communities vibrant in terms of economics and jobs, environmental groups, schools, you name it. Those are the kinds of groups where we connect with each other. We know what's going on. We know our neighbors. We meet our neighbors. We build relationships. What do they do? What could they do? Educate about the risks, assist in taking preventive measures, provide social support in a case of emergency, reach particular into groups that a lot of government services don't get to. So, you know, a lot of faith communities often have membership in linguistically or socially isolated communities, and that's an enormously important asset to have. Help people make their way through all these services and, you know, government bureaucracy. I mean, that's a service, that's a job in and of itself, as many of you know. And then folks who work for environmental justice. I mean, those are the kinds of issues that, you know, you see coming through in this discussion of vulnerability. Now, let me turn to just one sort of summary way of looking at this. Is, you know, social vulnerability really just a matter all of economics? This is a map that shows per capita income in the county. So based on that, you would say, you know, the mountainous area is not so bad off. There's a little of a low spot there in the valley, and then folks in the center, Fresno City and surroundings, are best off. Well, if it were all economics, that would be, you know, where would you focus? Well, just in that one couple of blocks there in the valley. If you take a more comprehensive view that takes into account demographics, age, race, language capacity, all those kinds of education, all these things, you get to this. It's a much more differentiated picture. Still, as you can see, the valley turns out to be socially most vulnerable, but there are a few spots even within that that are actually not the worst off. You know, the northeastern corner of the county is probably one where you don't have to worry so much. The city itself, probably very much dominated by the economic issues, but not only, is not the core issue. So basically, an indicator like this helps you to get sort of high priority areas. That's very good. But, you know, that's, if you want to look at particular risks, particular populations, you got to drill down. So let me do the sort of same thing here for economic sectors. We list here in this table, unfortunately, it's hard to see, basically the employment by sector in the county. And the leading two sectors are service industries and agriculture, with each one 21% of the total employment in the county is in those two sectors. A lot of the rest of the sectors actually are supporting agriculture and services. So they're very tightly linked. And the maps on that you see basically reflect that. Total employment in agriculture is the top map, and service industries employment is the bottom map. So that's basically why in the next few slides here, I'm going to focus primarily on agriculture. We already heard, this is just a summary slide, of the climatic threats to agriculture, ranging from generally higher temperatures, but maybe more importantly, the extreme temperatures at certain times in the year. Reduced water availability and growing competition for that with LA and others. more intense downpours, which can be damaging, soil erosion, those kinds of issues. Water demand by plants and animals will increase with higher temperatures. So at the same time that you get less, you have a higher demand for more. Reduced number of chill hours is a very important thing for a lot of stone fruit that are grown here in the county. So those that need a long period of hours per year under, say, 45 degrees or something like that, Some of those varieties may not no longer have a sufficient number of cold or cool hours to set fruit and bear adequately. Effects of changing climate on crop pollination, that's an area that's not as well understood, but essentially higher temperatures, especially early on in the year when the buds first open, could be damaging ultimately to the amount of fruit. And then finally, the risk of pest and infestation, spread of invasive plant species, it's one of the less obvious ones, but one of the things we keep finding is that things like weeds benefit a lot more than the things we actually care about, the crop, from higher CO2 levels. So you get more weeds, you have to spend more money on fighting the pests and the weeds. So those are the threats we're looking at. Okay, here is just a quick item on what makes different farms more or less vulnerable, depending on, you know, exposure has a lot to do with what are you growing? What kind of crops are you growing, and what are the specific threats to that from climate change? But on top of that is, so where are you located? Are you slightly up on the slope, or are you in the hottest part of the county, in the valley? The types and diversity of crops. If you grow basically monoculture, one thing, and that one is really sensitive to higher temperatures, you're in much worse shape than if you have a diverse agriculture where you're not going to be affected with one full swoop by the changes. What are your current farming practices? I mean, be it conventional, organic, be it, you know, intercropping, water conservation measures, you name it, whatever you use. Access to water resources, we all know not everyone has the same rights to water or access to those. What are your financial resources? Typically, smaller farms have much less access to resources than bigger farms. You see the top graphic there shows the number of farms. So the ones on the left are the smallest farms, and then a smaller number of bigger farms, and so on and so forth. Access to insurance, you know, whether you're working in cooperatives where you can share resources and information, and then other constraints or restrictions on your operations. Now let's look to important services, water. The threats, we already heard it, supply reduction, quality changes, flooding and runoff. And what are the current stressors? Those are the things that make it already hard to supply those services at an affordable rate and sustainable rate. Growing demand due to growth, and there will be growing demand because of the climate changes already experienced and more so in the future. Already there is overpumping. Already we deal with aging infrastructure. Groundwater pumping and banking, both of them, as well as desal, to the extent that that's not a key issue here, although it may become an issue in other parts of California that affects the water markets and the prices for water. All those are actually energy intensive. So as, you know, if you want to do more pumping, fine, but that then has impacts on the mitigation side, on your greenhouse gas emissions, right? So you can't just say, let's just pump until the day, you know, cows come home. High water costs, septic systems, water treatment facilities, some of them, especially in the most rural areas, are septic systems that are aging and need to be maintained. What about infrastructure? The threats from climate change, and here I want to emphasize, it's not just what happens with energy in particular and transportation. It's not just what happens within the county. It also, what happens outside, because we're so connected. I mean, completely interconnected in all our transportation, energy, and information systems. So you can't just think, you know, it's all here and that's all we have to worry about. I don't go into that here in any detail, but those things we should consider and discuss. Extreme heat, flash floods, high runoff, wildfire, landslides, sea level rise, which affects coastal power plants. Those kinds of things are the threats that, you know, are the sort of the physical threats from climate change on the infrastructure. At the same time, we have higher demand on them, both from growth. I mean, you would have an energy issue in this county without climate change, but the higher we have the summer temperatures when we use most anyway, you also have the additional energy demand from that. Same with traffic volume increases and then the aging levee issues. So those are the kinds of issues that will essentially make the functioning of the entire economy possible or not. Then finally here, emergency response services. Because of the growth in extreme events that we're expecting with climate change and with more people moving into areas that are at risk, be it, for example, the slopes up to the Sierra or floodplains or you name it, basically you have a greater demand for those services. You will need more often to pull out the fire trucks, to pull out all the services that you need. And probably because of the higher frequency, you don't have that much time in between to recover from whatever event you had and to rebuild your resources in that area. That means probably that the dependence on state and federal services is going to go up. Because none of us have locally enough money to basically keep dealing with those emergencies. So those are the kinds of issues and the strains on resources that you will have to deal with. Now, that's just sort of the very quick sort of overview. What are we going to do here is basically use the available resource and everything you heard today to basically, with your knowledge of these systems, to deepen our understanding on each one of them and what we can do. So the first piece is going to be, I'm just going to put all of these up here, sort of what concerns you most. Based on what you just heard in these different breakout groups that we have, which climate threat concerns you most, say, in the health sector or in the ag sector or for infrastructure? Who or what is going to be affected? So we're getting at this exposure piece. And then why? Like, what are the issues here? How are they sensitive? What's their capacity to deal with this? Okay, so we're going to spend about an hour talking about that, and then another hour, let me just put this out here, is to identify then strategies that reduce exposure, that reduces sensitivity, and that enhances the response capacity. So that's how the two discussions really go together. And then look at, what resources and programs do we have to deal with these, and what additional things might we need. And we should maybe think a little bit about, if ag needs a lot of water, but, the water sector people say, we need more for our urban populations, maybe we ought to have a conversation whether our adaptation strategies actually work together, okay? So we should have that exchange as well. And then sort of leave the day with some action steps that we can present to the folks that will be at the next meeting. So with that, let's get started to work on that. Or I guess we have one more brief presentation. And if you want any more information, ask either Julie. She did most of the work, so she will know most of the answers, or myself. Thanks.
Thanks, Susie. And again, we're going to unfortunately have to skip questions for now. So if you have any questions, ask Susie or Julie Ekstrom over the lunch period. So before we dive into the actual strategies, before we dive into our food and then dive into the actual strategies, we wanted to set the stage a little bit for our development of the strategies and talk about existing regional efforts, which really will be the foundation for the strategies we develop. So I want to turn it over to Tom Webster with the COG. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tom Webster with Fresno COG, and I'm going to try to be brief here following the doctor's three. I don't have don't have quite those credentials, but I have been working on the blueprint here at Fresno COG for about a year and a half, and the blueprint has been going on for roughly about 5 years in the Valley. And so I just want to kind of give just a couple of I'm going to make it brief because I know that we want to get out to lunch, but in a nutshell, the blueprint in the Valley is basically sustainable planning based on quality of life principles. And because there's always a lot of people are always asking, well, what's blueprint? Well, is it land use planning? Is it transportation planning? But I think the main thing is it's quality of life planning. And during the going back to 2005, at the beginning of sort of what was the blueprint process here, and some of the other regions in the state had been going through blueprint. The SACOG region had been undergoing some blueprint work there. They were in the beginnings there. And we started in the Valley to go through a process where we were going to look at what issues in the Valley were going to be the most important. So a vetting process about what were going to be the most important issues in the Valley in terms of quality of life. So there was 12 principles that the Valley came up with. And everything is also on the Blueprint website if anybody wants to go there and dig in a little bit further. There was a land use planning scenario exercise that was gone through to look at how these different principles might look given different types of land use development patterns. And we used a tool called UPlan that was developed by UC Davis, and that sort of gave us some scenarios in which we could look at different planning models. You know, so if we put if we stop growth here, where do we get more growth? How can we sort of shift these transportation and land use connection patterns, you know, to focus on maybe more transit oriented development or higher densities, and what are the benefits of that? But our modeling tools really weren't up to speed to give us the more robust type of granular, you know, tools and data that we were looking for outcomes. But in this process, we did come up with a scenario that was adopted by the Regional Policy Council for the San Joaquin Valley that put an average density development for new development in the valley at 6.8 units per acre. Now, it doesn't seem like a lot, but some areas that are more rural have a higher or have a lower density requirement, whereas some have maybe perhaps a higher density requirement. So in the Fresno, Clovis metropolitan area, we're looking at increasing those densities to carry some of the averages across the more rural areas. So while 6.8 doesn't seem to be a very high number to some estimates, you know, we here in the valley have that is really kind of where we've landed. So I'm going to talk about some of the work that we're doing now in the blueprint roadmap implementations phase. So after this vetting process, we decided that we would go ahead and move forward with a fourth-year grant application, and Fresno COG decided to become the lead applicant for that grant. Merced County Association of Governments had been the lead on the blueprint project for the first 3 years of the visioning and staging process. And the implementation phase, really, as I've seen it, this is where I came on board. The implementation phase really is almost just a staging for the real implementation. What we're really doing is we're developing more tools, data, models, so that we can actually start to have a better understanding of what different land use scenario plannings actually look like. And so Blueprint, you know, up until this point has really been sort of an exercise in gathering data and looking at different models to give us a better understanding of our impacts on the environment. So I think that I'm going to talk about some of the main tools that are coming out of the blueprint. One of them is a modeling improvement program. We could receive $2.5 million from the Strategic Growth Council to improve our model. That's our transportation model, and we're going to be working also in incorporating land use tools into that model, so that we can, you know, better assess the impacts of transportation and the effects of land use changes on transportation systems. We're also one of the things that has come up in our discussions, and we've put out some surveys to find out where some of the stumbling blocks might be in the blueprint, and that there was a firm belief that if we don't have the types of tools that can measure what the financial impact of different types of land use developments are on the system, then we really aren't going to have the political will to support blueprint principles and the types of changes that we would need to get there. And so we're working with SACOG on their costing model so that we can do just that. So, you know, we could build it, but can we own it? What does it cost to own a sprawl development in terms of services, the delivery of services? I heard we were talked about services, water, fire and rescue, police services, road maintenance, infrastructure. Those things not only have to be built, but they have to be maintained over time. So in this model, our goal is to have a model to base it on the SACOG model, so that we can measure and scenario plan based on if we want a high density development versus maybe we want to look at what a high density development versus a mixed use development in an area, that a blighted area, what there might be, what the impacts might be, what the cost of the infrastructure might be, and what the cost of ownership might be on that. And I believe there's also a component that will look at the cost of the actual real estate value in those areas too. Now, these models are actually quite a ways away, but these are things that we're working on. So those are sort of the tools that we're working on to move this implementation phase a little bit closer to implementation. So SB 375 comes along as we're beginning this, looking at our implementation tools phase. And so it really kind of changed the way that we looked at our implementation. So we went back and thought, what can we get out of Prop 84? Prop 84, which is the Strategic Growth Council has been is responsible for monitoring Prop 84 and giving us grant funds or allocating grant funds from Prop 84 to basically implement SB 375. And we just submitted a $2.5 million grant application to the Strategic Growth Council. And I think that the areas that we are looking to develop our program under with the Prop 84, which are also sort of fall under the blueprint, I think are really in line with the kinds of things that have been in conversation here today. So the first thing that we're looking at is the development of an SCS. And we have to be SCS, we have to have an SCS RTP in our next cycle. We are getting ready to adopt our RTP. In the next 4 years, we have to have an SCS compliant RTP. I'm not gonna get into the APS versus SCS, but basically we have to have an SCS compliant RTP. That's the sustainable community strategy. And that is to meet the targets that CARB has given us for greenhouse gas reductions. Okay, so that is going to be one of the major components of the grant that we have just submitted. So that's a program element that we're looking at. Another major program element is going to be the development of general plan tools, actual tools, not just more planning, but the actual tools in the communities to actually begin to do climate action plans and general plan update work. So we're focusing on the cities around throughout the entire valley that are 50,000 population and below, and the counties and the unincorporated communities. We have put a program together for that also includes climate action plan updates, and we haven't actually figured out exactly where we will be looking at the divisions between whether we're going to be looking at population size or we're going to be looking at socioeconomic demographics or just sub-regions, but that will be a major component of that general plan work. And then the final one is a green print. We're looking at doing a pretty comprehensive green print, which was not only a promise of the blueprint, but has also been going on in lots of other studies simultaneously. So we have, I know that the Tulare Lake Basin Wildlife Project was brought up. UC Davis did a habitat corridor study plan. We have the farmland conservation plan here, which is looking at strategic farmland and ag land throughout the valley to figure out how we can preserve and conserve and the value of you know, strategic farmland. And then we also have the urban forestry program and the trails programs. And so what we're trying to do with the green print is we're trying to bring these groups together so that we can find out what the best fit is so that the green print becomes sort of the counterbalance to the urban development program. So we have an urban development program, which really is sort of containing the growth. And then we would have a counterbalance to that, which would be the green print program, which would actually, you know, would actually be the open space preservation part. So that would include parks and recreation area, habitat corridor conservation, maybe mitigation banks, buffer zones, ag land preservation, and those kinds of things, so that we can begin to actually fill the policy requirements. We need some robust policy prescriptions, not prescriptions, but that's not the word we use in the blueprint, but we need some actual substance in a green print program that we can actually take to boards and planning departments to say this is actually has a payoff to it, and this is something that we can and would like to implement. So that's where we are with the blueprint and the sustainable community strategies, green print, and Prop 84. There's also an urban component that is going on sort of simultaneously to this under a HUD grant. I don't know if the awards have been made, but the cities, the 15 of the major cities in the valley applied for a HUD grant. HUD, I believe it's HUD, DOT, and EPA grant to do the 50,000 and above component of what we're doing. So they're going to be looking at the urban development side of the sustainable planning in the valley. So that's it.
Thanks, Tom. And lastly, we're going to hear briefly from Joseph Oldman. Now that you know, you're right on before lunch. You've got the really good spot here.
Oh,
We're going to hear briefly about the Fresno Green Program.
Yeah, okay. I'm competing with my stomach. Okay. Let's see. Well, I'm going to make this really brief. The City of Fresno has a sustainability program. It's called Sustainable Fresno. It's built off the Fresno Green program that we developed, started in 2007, which basically looked at ideas and strategies on how the city could become a sustainable community by 2025. And that vision was really a shorter-term vision. It was focused out around 2012, 2015 was the length of that. And so we were fortunate enough to receive some funding from the Department of Energy in 2009 and formed a sustainability division, which I oversee and manage. And we decided that we needed to take our vision out through 2035. And there's some efforts underway right now. And these are the challenges we face. I won't go through them. You pretty much know them. The one thing that I will draw your attention to is the fact that in 2007, the city of Fresno as a community, now this is all the residents, all the industry, all the businesses, spent roughly about $750 million on energy in the form of electricity and natural gas. That was actually kind of a shocking number for us. We didn't realize that the city as a community was spending that kind of money on energy. Now, that excludes transportation fuels. And I'm sure if we did the analysis for transportation fuels, which is a harder analysis to do, we'd find that the number was way over $1 to $1.5 billion, maybe $2 billion that's spent in this community a year on energy, which is pretty impressive. Our population figures, you know, you saw some of the numbers this morning. The city potentially will grow to 1 million, Fresno Clovis Metro 1.5 million, the county up to 2 million, four county region up to 4 million in the next 50 to 60 years. We know that if we do things right, potentially we have some opportunities to make some improvements. You know, as it was brought out, this is the mitigation thing. This is putting on the brakes. This is slowing things down, seeing if the impacts can be slowed in a way that, you know, will make it better for us as a community. We know that resource efficiency, conservation, innovation, all of these things play a role. And we believe that Fresno can be a very attractive place in the future if we do it right. So we set some programs in place. These programs are designed to get us where we need to be. And we're looking at a 30% improvement in energy efficiency across all new development and within the existing built environment. And then looking at the same types of improvements through uses of renewable energy, and then looking at a substantial reduction in our use of water. You know, 300 gallon per person per day number, LA is at 150. And they're planning on all of their future growth to be accomplished through conservation measures and, you know, holding the line. Well, we've got a ways to go. We've got to get down way below where we are currently, and that's going to be a challenge. We're looking at how these things can be implemented across city operations. So basically, we're not excluding ourselves from this. We want to whatever we're doing, we want to lead by example and show the community how we can do that. We set up basically a interconnected series of programs and. They all work together to achieve this. I'm not going to go through all of this, but and I can provide you a link to see how this works. But basically, it's working together with all the stakeholders in the community, in the region, to come up with comprehensive plans and programs that get us towards a sustainable community. And one of the first things that we've done is we've started rolling out free energy surveys for homeowners in the city of Fresno. We've done over 1,000 of those to date. We're pretty proud of that. We've had about a 95% plus satisfaction rating. These surveys help homeowners identify opportunities for saving energy and saving money. That's the one thing that we really emphasize. This is a money-saving effort. It's good for their pocketbook right now. We're looking really at these programs as the now and the future. And so if we don't deal with the now, we're not going to get to the future. And we can't just be looking at the future because we need to address things now. So these are some of the things that we're doing. We use thermal imaging cameras to highlight areas in the home where insulation's lacking, where there might be mold intrusion, other discrepancies This actually works really well showing up if their ducts are leaking, and we've found that that's a big problem in Fresno. Just for relativity's sake, we ask the homeowner to give us a year's worth of their energy data, and we help them get it. We look at their monthly costs. We take their highest bills, and we have seen bills as high as $2,400 for 1 month for a residential homeowner in the city of Fresno. It's not uncommon to find bills anywhere from $600 to $1,200 in 1 month. Now, if you go back to that $750 million investment that people are making in this community in energy, if we could cut 30% reduction off of that, that's $225 million we could plow back into our economy. The whole idea of green jobs and a green economy, it really can exist. We're wasting huge amounts of energy in this community. And if we make an investment to save that, we can put that back in our own pockets and make our economy much better for all of us. Financing is a real problem. When we did polls of our homeowners, we found that basically they don't have any money. They're willing to do things if we can show that they're cash flow positive, and about 15% of the homeowners that we've surveyed and provided the service for up to this point have actually taken action and done work, and PG&E was actually quite impressed with that number. And so we've been working with the Energy Commission as well as Fresno County to develop new and innovative financing programs of energy efficiency, and we're pleased to say that the state just rolled out their Energy Upgrade California financing program, which we're going to be marketing heavily in the community, not only in all of Fresno County, but also in Kern County. We just received a new grant from the CEC to help us do that. Renewable energy deployment is a big factor in what our future plans are. The city has roughly a 3-megawatt investment in renewables in the form of solar. And then we have about a 9-megawatt gas turbine array at our wastewater treatment plant that uses about 50% of the gas for that power plant comes from biogas that we produce from the plant, which becomes a renewable resource. We have an RFP that's being looked at right now for up to another 4 megawatts of solar on our city facilities, and we've identified at least 46 megawatts of capacity within the city facilities alone. The trick, though, becomes can it be done cost effectively where we actually are able to save money on it? Because, again, it's down to the now, folks. You know, city governments, county governments, we're all struggling just to keep the lights on, keep the services going. And if we can't show a savings today, there won't be staff around to develop a future. So this is what we're trying to do now to, you know, keep all of this moving. We have a whole new effort underway that I think Franklin had to leave, but unfortunately, he is one of the key players in this. We're looking at a whole new general plan update focused on 2035 and a whole new Fresno development code that will help us get mixed-use development along key transportation corridors and increasing density along those corridors to help us contain the growth of the city in terms of its overall boundaries. Most of you know kind of what the city of Fresno looks like. Right there is a nice little map that shows this bunch of little grids, you know, along a half-mile increment. It's kind of the typical sprawl type of development that's happened all across the country since the end of World War II. This is the new ideas that we're promoting and looking at now with our new general plan update. Those corridors that you see listed up there or shown up there in gray are existing major street corridors. We're planning on increasing densities along those corridors with strategic activity centers at nodes out at the far ends of those. Those corridors would be bus rapid transit corridors and potentially light rail corridors at some point in the future. And we're very excited about the potential for high-speed rail coming through the valley and the opportunities that that might offer. So the idea is to connect our corridors and our activity centers to that high-speed rail. Of course, downtown is a key focus of that. And of course, I think most of you know, the mayor and the city council have been actively engaged in trying to revitalize our downtown area and make it a more mixed-use 24-hour-a-day activity center. So these are just some shots of, you know, the kind of mixed-use development and higher density development that we'd like to see. And that's about it. Not too bad.
Thanks, Joseph. So This morning we heard about the really big, scary, overwhelming issues, and we tried to ease us back into a place where there was some hope with, you know, all the great things that are happening regionally. So they're really, the region has a great start on addressing these issues. And this afternoon is where even more hope comes in, where we really need all of you to help us to identify the additional things that need to be done in the region. So I really encourage you all to stay. This is your chance to make a really big difference on these issues. We did a similar process in San Luis Obispo County. We did a workshop just like this. We had the local stakeholders like all of you, and the strategies that we developed out of that process are now being implemented into the county general plan. They're updating some of their elements into the city's general plan, into the air district state implementation plan. The county public health department is looking at the strategies we developed. They're getting put into climate action plans, regional transportation plans. So there's a really big opportunity here to make a big difference. So hope that you can all stick with us through the afternoon. There's lunch out in the hallway there, and we'll go ahead and come back at 12:55. So we'll have a half an hour, and we'll regroup in here, and then we'll split out into the discussion groups. Thanks. I'll do just, you know, next steps, and then if you want to do
that. I'll just thank them again for coming, and then the next day.
Yeah, October 21st. So the way that's going to work is that we probably won't have all these things that we'll back, but we'll identify kind of the key, and we'll just say that, you know, that'll be our next step, but it's not necessary.
Numbers are so hard. The data on electricity and natural gas was pretty straightforward because we were able to get it from PG&E. But when you start getting into the fuel consumption data, that's a very big guessing game. Now we do know, we have a sense that you know, it's probably
are you
twice.
Good at putting the jokes
probably,
in here?
It yeah. probably doubles that number because we saw when we did our carbon analysis for our EDCBG application that roughly 58% of our carbon footprint for the city as a whole was from transportation sources. So if you think, okay, 60-40 split, and if you're spending $750 million a year on electricity and natural gas, you know, what,
emergency preparedness. You know,
what would be that number? Well, okay, double it, you know, at least, and maybe more.
Do we know what the VMT
is? I haven't met her in person, so I don't know if I am.
Not measured. I don't think that there's been an action. The COG, I think, has done some more. They've been working on it. They have a new regional transportation study that they're doing that may give us a better handle on
the
numbers. But I think that that's, you know, I don't think anybody has, to be honest. I mean, if you look at the amount of commuters, the city is actually the city core. I mean, there's about 50,000 people.
Yeah, we'll come back and in the parts, and we'll have the presentation.
And at night, this becomes a ghost town, and they all migrate
so
on north,
no, that's gonna
south,
happen at about 1.
And
okay,
you know, northwest. You know, they and due south. If you look at the volume on the 41.